This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts discusses how to foster a meaningful dialogue on today's grand challenges, ranging from environmental crisis to social and political upheaval. This event was put on to celebrate the University of Utah's 50th anniversary of its College of Social and Behavioral Science. The panel includes the event's keynote speaker, Catherine Hayhoe, Chief Scientist at the Natural Conservancy and Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Texas Tech University. The other distinguished panelists are professors from the University of Utah's College of Social and Behavioral Science. Speaking first will be Lisa Aspinwall, Professor of Psychology. Following her will be Thomas Kova, Professor of Geography, Edmund Fong, Associate Professor of Political Science and Chair of the Division of Ethnic Studies, Claudia Geist, Associate Professor of Gender Studies and Sociology, and Rick Larson, President and CEO of the Sutherland Institute. Moderating the panel is Brent Steele, Chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Utah. This forum was recorded on April 18th, 2022. Here is the panel's first speaker, Lisa Aspinwall.
Things that threats to health and threats to the environment have in common is that they are things that are near and dear to us, but we're asked to do things now that are expensive or inconvenient to prevent something even worse from happening later. They've also been found to be things that promote motivated reasoning. So when we see a conclusion that occasions us to have to do more or to change what we want to do, we're much harder on the quality of the evidence, and we engage in things like counter-arguing. What is worse is that both certain health risks and climate risks are highly politicized and polarized. And even worse than that, they're polarized in ways where these attitudes are value expressive. They're attitudes that we want people to know us by. So whether we have a "We Believe" sign in front of our home, or whether we're wearing a MAGA hat, these are things where we want people to understand who we are by our own sharply divided attitudes. So when we think of these similarities, it's going to take an awful lot to change them. But there are some things in Dr. Hayhoe's approach, based on my understanding, my appreciation of your TED talk, where there are some intersections in terms of communications based on shared values. So if we look at Love Thy Neighbor, this is the social media campaign of the Catholic Health Association of the US, you can link recommended health behaviors to important values, like encouraging people to get vaccinated. Shared values highlight similarity, and interestingly, even incidental similarities can promote dialogue between members of different groups. So something as seemingly unimportant as sharing the first letter of your first name with somebody, or rooting for the same sports team. But I'm going to argue that there's something very special about affirming a value, in that there's a very nice experimental literature where people who are given the opportunity to write about an important value, whether it's economic, political, aesthetic, and so on, are then more receptive to negative information that matters to them. So in the domain of health, people who have a chance to affirm their past acts of kindness are more willing to read information about the health risks of their caffeine consumption, and less likely to try to pick that information apart. So this, I think, has some great potential. And as you'll see, it intersects nicely with research on intergroup relations. So the classic studies, your social scientist dream in the study of intergroup relations, is the classic Sharif and Sharif Robbers Cave summer camp studies, where you're able to bring together boys who are all the same age, same ethnicity, same socioeconomic status, create different groups of friends, and then investigate whether putting these groups in their conditions of competition or cooperation promotes intergroup friendship and liking. And what they found very rapidly is that when groups compete, conflict escalates. What they found is that it took a very special kind of situation, a very special kind of cooperation, to reduce animosity and promote cross-group friendship. And that was a superordinate goal. By that I mean a goal or thread that exceeded any individual's group ability to manage it, and that required cooperation for shared benefit. So specifically, they engineered a breakdown in the camp's water supply. And when the kids worked together to fix that, that promoted intergroup friendship. Now, Is a superordinate goal, is climate change going to be that superordinate goal that brings the world together to promote intergroup cooperation? It would be lovely to hold up a social psych textbook and say that, great, we already have the superordinate goal. The problem is that we have a situation that is so severely polarized that when partisan identity is emphasized, people reject solutions offered by the other party out of hand, using the party identifier as a quick heuristic for whether you need to deal with this and whether it could possibly be any good. So instead of just the superordinate goal, we may also need the superordinate identity. So people have found, for example, that priming identities of people as Americans rather than partisans decreases attention to the divisive party labels and improves various kinds of thinking about the environment and climate change. So when we look at Kennedy's famous comment, we all breathe the same air, we all live downstream, one planet, one future, these are all calls to that broader superordinate identity. Now, I want to introduce the cautionary tale. There is a nice literature in both social psychology and political psychology on the effects of bringing groups together to talk about similarities rather than differences. And in some ways, this is successful. Similarities-focused intergroup discussions increase perceptions of trust and fairness between groups. Removing party identifiers from solutions has been shown to improve learning about basic scientific literacy skills, like how to read climate change data, such that if you leave in who suggested it, people aren't learning. If you remove those identifiers, people are. Now, what's the problem with that? Come on, clicker. It would help if I knew where the computer was to point to. Okay. What I'd like to caution us against is a phenomenon called the irony of harmony that Tamir Sagi and her colleagues identified, where focusing on similarities between groups may lead to increased expectations of fairness. But in experimental studies, in the lab, and in field studies in countries marked by conflict, those expectations of fairness are not necessarily met by equitable outcomes. And further, when people start to expect better treatment from the other group, it's been shown to demotivate people to change something about society. So it creates the perception that everything is good, but in fact, it ignores some of the inequalities among groups. And one of the things I'm going to suggest is that the social inequalities in exposure to adverse effects of climate change must remain a part of this dialogue. Thank you.
Good afternoon. As mentioned, I'm Tom Cover from the Department of Geography. And I don't have slides today, so I'll just talk. So climate change is upending historic environmental norms. And it doesn't matter whether you're interested in glaciers or air quality or fires, floods, or many, many other environmental dimensions out there. You can see them changing. As Dan Swain put it, he's tired of living in a real-life disaster movie. Every time he looks at the weather, records are breaking. Last week it was heat records in California, then it's some other records somewhere else. We've always had extreme events. That's not new. So earthquakes, fires, floods, hurricanes. But it's different, right? Something's different. What's different? Well, they're happening in places they haven't before. They're happening in time periods they haven't before, you know, outside of historic seasons. They're happening with greater intensity and in some cases, longer duration. So I'll give you an example. For me, the real wake-up call, I think, was the Chimney Tops 2 fire in Tennessee in 2016. So, you know, after following wildfires for years, maybe decades, I guess, probably like 20 years, it's late November, and 14 people die in a fire in Tennessee, a wildfire. And I mean, I'd only been studying the Western US, and it's not like there isn't wildfires in Australia and Portugal and everywhere else, but Tennessee in November was different. And then people dying. And I'm like, how did this happen? What burned? I mean, the trees had lost their leaves. Environmental people in the room were going, oh, I know. Leaf litter on the ground was so dry during the drought. And then it didn't start necessarily that close to Gatlinburg, but then you have 14 people dying. So why weren't they warned? Why didn't they leave? If that was the end of the story, it would have just been a real outlier. But then next year, the Tubbs Fire in Sonoma. Again, 14 people. Why? What happened? How did they not get warned? It didn't start right in the community. It took a while, hours, to get to the nearest people. It started in a very low density area, oak kind of landscape, and then eventually turned into a massive urban conflagration, igniting structure to structure. The year after that was then the big one. That was the Camp Fire. I know, terrible name, but it was named after a road, Camp Road. 85 people died, 26,000 structures, and a massive worldwide event, right, that I'm sure all of you are familiar with. But those three, really, it was like, something's really changing. You know, this is not a textbook kind of thing. And in the year 2100, which when I came, talk about 2100, then we started talking about 2075, 2050. No, it's happening now. It's not, you don't have to talk about whether you think it's gonna happen or not anymore. So, I could go on and on and on, but the one I wanted to focus on, the most recent one, was Marshall Fire, Boulder County, December 30th, that just passed. So we're just talking 3 months ago. Colorado's most destructive fire in history occurred on December 30th and burned through the suburbs. It wasn't even a wildfire area. If you look at a hazard map, wildfire hazard map for Colorado, it's not on the map. It's not considered wildland-urban interface. 100 and something mile an hour winds, igniting structures, chain reaction. So it's unsettling, I guess, is my summary on studying this stuff. So I guess to fit it with grand challenges and Catherine's visit, the grand challenge is, how do we protect people in a world like this? How do, if you put yourself in the shoes of emergency managers, they're seeing events in their counties they've never seen. Some of them have never occurred anywhere. So how do you make sure the public is safe? Well, it's difficult. I wrote a paper on it last year where I said, try to prepare for the unprecedented. So whatever scenarios you're thinking about, think outside the box. If you were asking how long is it going to take to get everybody out of this community, maybe you should reverse the question and say, how many can we get out in 2 hours, in 1 hour, if we end up having one of these Marshall Fire scenarios? Also think outside the box with co-occurring and cascading disasters. I was on a Zoom call last year where an emergency manager from Utah said, if you had told me in 2019 you wanted me to do an earthquake scenario during a global pandemic, he would have laughed and said, I'll humor you, but that's never going to happen. And 6 months later, there they are at the table dealing with the, let's see, the Magna quake, right? So think outside the box with scenarios. Technological advancements offer some help. So cell phones are a major help, especially wireless emergency alerts. So we have some tools on our sides that we didn't used to have. Boulder County, there's a happy ending to that. First of all, no one died. Well, one person died, I think, in the Marshall Fire. But they had the Boulder Fire since then. And they did sign up for the wireless emergency alert system, and they did issue wireless emergency alerts. And the incident commander said it was a major factor in improving the safety and getting everyone out in that second fire. So they got two fires since December, both with dramatic, dire evacuations. But it's a power tool we didn't used to have. And then thinking about backup plans. So if the environment is going to throw us curveballs outside the box, then we need to think outside the box on protecting people. So, Australia is kind of ahead of us with fire bunkers. That's the one I think about the most. But also any kind of protective gear. It's interesting, if you tell people they're going to go to Antarctica, they wouldn't hesitate to get really warm clothing and shelter and everything else. But if you tell someone their neighborhood might become 2,000 degrees, they get very uncomfortable about a fire suit and thinking about anything that would be the equivalent side on the heat end of it. So I've actually used that to agitate people to think more about the development they live in and whether or not they should add more homes and densities of homes. And it's like, I tell them, it's okay, you can add another 100 homes, but start thinking about fire suits. And they don't want to. So to summarize, if we're going to experience all these extreme events, then yeah, we need to step up our game. And it's daunting, because it was daunting before climate change started throwing us all these curveballs.
Hi, everyone. So I'm Edmund. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Political Science and the Division of Ethnic Studies. So I think I was asked to be on this panel to talk about critical race theory. There's really not much to be said about that I'll add. I mean, anyone who's sort of seriously engaged with critical race theory knows that it's a decades-long body of scholarly thought, not monolithic in any way. For a long time, one of the few serious efforts to really sort of grapple with systemic racism on an everyday level, and so I think it's been broadly diffused across many disciplines since then. So I think there's really not much more to say about that beyond that. But what I do want to talk about, though, is I think sort of the polarization, a theme that we're all sort of hitting at, I think, especially around racial politics. One of the things I like about Catherine's work is this emphasis on trying to reach for shared values. I think in the realm of racial politics that I'm more familiar with, the shared values are evident across American history. The problem, of course, is that traditions, rival and antagonistic traditions have developed that use the same documents, that use the same words, but express kind of polar opposite, polarized views of them. And so that's a challenge, not so much just reaching for and finding shared values, but trying to grapple with how over time those values have come to be seen as quite antithetical to one another. And so I'll give you a few examples of what I mean in sort of my world. One, many of you are probably familiar with the phrase, Sunday is the most segregated day in America, right? I mean, so that's an example of how people worship on a single day, and yet that happens to be one of the most divided days year after year, right? So that's a kind of flip sort of example of what I mean. A more historical example, I tend to teach courses on the history of racial politics in the US. I love engaging with students. Lincoln's second inaugural address, for a refresher, this is at the end of the Civil War. Lincoln gives this speech. He highlights and puts front and center slavery as the cause of the Civil War. Right? He would be assassinated about a week or two after giving this inaugural address. And everyone expected him to kind of crow, right, with the success of the Union forces, but he doesn't do so, right? Those of you who have read the second inaugural know what I mean. And so one of the sort of key passages I love to put before my students, Lincoln says, "Both read the same Bible, both pray to the same God, both invokes his assistance against the other. It may seem strange," Lincoln says, "it may seem strange to ask a just God's assistance in wringing the bread from the sweat of other men's faces, but let us not judge so we be not judged." So I think the takeaway for me, at least, and people can differ, the takeaway for me is, I think, kind of a spirit that Catherine has shared in her work, a kind of humility, or a willingness to kind of estrange ourselves from our own sort of deeply held values, to think, well, hold on a minute, our values have, the things that I really believe in have been sort of, we've come to accept them in ways that are quite closed off to the views of others, even though there may be a shared basis underneath them, right? And so I'll close with one final example. All lives matter, Black lives matter. Two value statements, three words each, two of the words exactly the same, right? There's no logical tension between them. All should include Black, right? And there isn't even a basis for a logical contradiction, right? And yet, of course, right, some people will use the former as somehow a kind of dismissal or a retort against the latter, right? And so I think a willingness to kind of not sort of define the shared values, not because they're not there, but in order to reach that, you have to have a willingness to kind of take a step back, right, and say, hey, what's going on here? Right, we've had sort of these traditions of racial partisan polarization across American history. You know, different sides will invoke the Declaration of Independence, right? And yet, you know, a willingness to, you know, understand that, well, how have we come to this point where what I really believe in is sort of so opposed to another view that invokes the same words, right? Or similar words, right? And so I think what's necessary there is a certain kind of willingness to estrange oneself from, you know, our own sort of values. No false equivalence here, so I'm not trying to say that, right? I'm not saying that both sides or any parties to a debate are of equal, you know, value. But we won't understand that and reach a common ground unless we're able, willing and able to, you know, sort of take a step back, I think.
That was Edmund Fong, professor of political science and chair of the Division of Ethnic Studies. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, a panel of experts discusses how we can have a more constructive dialogue around our pressing social and environmental challenges. Here is your next panel speaker, Claudia Geist, Associate Professor of Gender Studies and Sociology.
Thank you all for being here. My task today is to talk about gender and gender inequality. And when I teach about gender, often I open my classes with telling students that if they're unsettled or potentially even like mad at me, and if everybody in the classroom is like somewhat unsettled and mad at me, like regardless of their sort of preconceived notions, like then I've done my my job well. But today I really try to follow sort of this idea of like finding common ground and how to communicate across. And I want to start with what I consider to be more low-hanging fruit, and then gradually, as time allows, things get thornier and thornier. When you think about gender inequality, many of you probably think about, you know, gender wage gaps, occupational segregation, comparisons between cisgender men and women, that is, people whose sex assigned at birth corresponds with their gender identity. And one of the things where I feel there's is, or really should be, lots of agreement on is that fairness, that is, opposition to unfair practices, that is like unequal pay for the same kind of labor, is just not really an acceptable business practice, and we should be united in combating it, even if some of us benefit from it. This is what I think on optimistic days. However, another path to think about is that everybody suffers from these kinds of inequalities. If you think about, you know, gender-based earnings penalties, you know, everyone who is in a family or financially depends on a woman who gets paid less because she is a woman suffers. So it really is a shared burden, and there's great potential, I believe, to sort of come together and espouse fairness, or at least agree that everybody suffers. When we think about occupational segregation, that is that oftentimes gender is a very strong predictor of what majors people pick up, what kinds of jobs they take, in what industries they select into. That is not just sort of a semantic problem, but it really is hampering progress. And what we need in order to solve big societal problems is like all kinds of inputs. We need people's brilliance to really shine in their fields and not have people select out because they feel they're not welcome or that they're faced with stereotypes. And we're missing out on wonderful early childhood educators who happen to be men. People maybe start engineering majors, but then maybe they feel discouraged. And there's so much that we can do, and it's really just right there to let people develop their capabilities without the constraints of gender. And I think there's lots of common ground there. What gets more difficult is that we need to remember that gender is not just like two big buckets, and that all we need to do is poke holes in the buckets, and then we're all just super happy and we have overcome. It's that the experience of gender really varies greatly based on other intersecting identities. And may that be race, ethnicity, class, you know, disability, so many different areas. And as academics, we have sometimes prioritized some identities over others, having left some groups of people, say people in rural areas, people who have not achieved higher educational achievement, like left them out there and often ignore the needs. And one of the things that is a sort of a commonsensical experience, but sometimes difficult for scholars to replicate, is that the experience of gender varies greatly depending on where you are in society, where you are in your life course. And scholars have a lot to learn. And there is another round of common ground. But I would be amiss to talk about gender inequality if I did not bring up a thorny issue where I hope for insights of those of you who really can see the connections better. Because one of the big concerns when we think about gender is that there is a big divide between like scholars like me who believe that gender is not simply a binary category, and people for whom the very definition of the gender binary is foundational to like everyday understanding, to faith beliefs, to like every aspect of their lives. There's glimmers of hope where even as a dyed-in-the-wool pessimist sometimes come through. I do collaborative research with Dr. Lisa Diamond from the Department of Psychology and Division of Gender Studies, where we talk to practicing members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who have non-binary or transgender kids, like adolescents and young adults. And we talk about the best practices and the challenges that they experience in like living out their love for their children, making sure that their kids feel safe without, you know, like outsiders telling them that they have to like jettison all of their values, like leave their church homes and their communities, which is difficult. And sometimes it's a harm reduction approach and sometimes criticized from all the sides. So there are ways, but there are some fundamental differences around gender that really are sort of a big hill to climb. When I thought back about like what we all can agree on in optimistic moments, I really think that sort of the societal future is something that all individuals have a stake in, and that often children represent sort of the hope for the future, and that if we can form sort of policies that support children regardless of, you know, what kind of living arrangement they live in, that actually can go a long way of, you know, mitigating some issues of gender inequality. Like, who pays for all the things that children need? There is an opportunity to support parents. Also, finding ways to support caregiving needs, and that is not just childcare, that is also elder care, and in rapidly aging societies, you know, elder care is something that may be in the books for all of the people in the room at some point, and to really figure out that this is not an individualized burden and duty. It's not just sort of a women's issue, but really it's a societal issue that we all have to address. And then to remind us of the humanity of people that we encounter, you know, sometimes I'm optimistic. And so thank you for forcing me to be optimistic about this.
Okay, am I on? It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate this invitation, and I've been thinking deeply about what I can add to this conversation. And from my professional experience, I think what I'd like to add is I'd like to connect two climate crises. You're all familiar with the one we're worried about every time we look at the Great Salt Lake and we watch the snowpack change, climate crisis. There's a political climate crisis that's making that and every other issue that we're facing more difficult. I'm very much aligned with Professor Hayhoe as I've listened to her speaking, read some of her work. We both address a similar communication disconnect in our daily work, and mine is focused on the arena of public policy in the state of Utah. And I'm increasingly concerned about the state of political discourse, not only in the nation, but increasingly here in Utah. There are extreme voices on both sides that are contributing to a climate of contempt that is not helpful in finding solutions. So when we as individuals choose to define every important issue through a lens of political ideology, rather than a concern for one another or a desire to find the best solution, we in reality are denying ourselves the solution because we're turning off part of the information. And America is rapidly progressing on a path of polarization. In fact, a study at Brown University says we're progressing faster than any other nation. There's a term, effective polarization, causes us to see everything and everyone first and foremost through a negative political lens. That's concerning, and it's contributing to a lot of the discomfort we all feel when we look at the world around us. And there are so many issues that demonstrate the truth of this research, from a pandemic to an election, the list goes on and on. But climate is particularly enlightening because despite the evidence of change all around us, we still find ways to argue about it. And that's an interesting revelation to think about it in those terms. And I believe even when you can get those on one side of the aisle to agree that there's a problem, it's the menu of action items that then becomes the point of division. So it feels like we can't win. So I'm an advocate of a couple of social scientists around the country who are writing and speaking extensively on this political division. I'm a student of Arthur Brooks, of Yuval Levin, if you've read any of their works. And it's disarmingly simple. Arthur Brooks teaches a class at Harvard. The subject matter is happiness, and it has the longest waiting list of any class in the Harvard Business School. Now, don't you find that interesting that of all the things you could study at Harvard, happiness is the subject that most young minds are dying to understand? There's a lesson in there. And they both speak on the fact that our political environment today is driven by contempt. Let me offer an important definition. We all know the word contempt. Contempt is more than disagreement. Contempt says, if someone disagrees with you, they're either evil or stupid and not worthy of your time. That's a significant change in attitude and discourse. And this is what occupies my work today, to try to inform sound public policy. And yes, my institute makes a case for conservative principles, but they're presented as ideas to debate, as possible solutions, not as a weapon with which to attack the other side. And that's a difference that I will advocate for the rest of my career, because unless we regain the capacity to do that, it's an existential threat. It's as dangerous as climate change. If you want to see our freedoms evaporate, let's continue to debate issues as we do today. It's not a productive course. It's also notable to realize, and I heard it mentioned here today, Back in 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency was created by a Republican administration. And I don't offer that as an excuse or look at what the Republicans did. I only offer it as evidence that there have been points, whether it be oil spills or some of the things that were happening proximate to that enactment, that did bring people together for a moment. And whatever the successes or failures have been, we are capable of seeing the importance in an issue across the aisle. When I look at this audience, when I spend time on this campus, and I spend time every opportunity I get because I like being here. I loved attending school here, and I still love being here. Walking this campus, I see future leadership, certainly of the state, possibly of the nation. And so I would just suggest to you that you are right to be upset about some of the issues we're facing today. You are right to activate your mind and your talents in response to these things. But please also, I would ask, make room for the ability to listen to the other side. The worst thing that's going to happen in sitting down with someone you disagree with is you'll understand them better. You'll understand why you disagree. There's value in that. You may also learn something in discussing their perspective that helps you formulate a response that says, well, now understanding how you see that, maybe there's potential in this course of action. And this is something we're losing at a rapid pace. Again, statistically, faster than any other nation. And so the challenge I would offer is, yes, be concerned about the things we're facing and apply this to any issue that you consider important and is affecting your life. But don't lose, within the passion that you develop that animates your response, develop the ability to listen to those you don't necessarily disagree with in an attempt to understand where they're coming from. Thank you.
Professor Hagel, any reflections before we move to question and answer?
Yes. So we've heard about many issues that might seem unrelated. And you might think of climate change as a separate issue at the end of the list. I like visual images, and so I often envision it as different buckets. You know, you're pouring all of your effort, your resources, your time, every bit of support you can give into each different bucket to address an issue that you're concerned about. And then along comes climate change at the end of the line, so to speak, and people are like, one more bucket. We'll get to it after we've dealt with this. But climate change is a bit different. It's not a separate bucket. It's not a separate issue. If it were a separate issue, you know, if all that were happening was by digging up and burning coal and gas and oil, we're producing heat-trapping gases that are wrapping an extra blanket around the planet, and it was causing the global average temperature to warm and nothing else, it would be a scientific curiosity. The reason we care about it is because climate change is not a separate bucket, it's the whole in every other bucket. So whether we care about issues of socioeconomic inequality, whether we care about having a healthy economy, whether we care about geopolitical conflicts and crises, whether we care about racial or gender equality, whether we simply care about having a safe place for our family to live, no matter what it is that we care about, climate change is the hole in the bucket. We will not be able to fill that bucket if we don't fix climate change. So the US military has a word for it, which I think is a phrase which is very relevant. They call it a threat multiplier. In most cases, and Tom pointed this out very clearly, in most cases, climate change is not creating a new problem that already existed. And we see this most obviously with wildfires, hurricanes, heat waves, droughts. We know that these have always existed as long as we've had an atmosphere on this planet. But we also know that climate change is loading the weather dice against us. Wildfires are burning more area. Droughts are more intense. Hurricanes are dumping more rainfall on us. Well, those might be more obvious, but we're seeing the same amplification effects with, for example, socioeconomic and racial inequalities. I'll just give you a very practical example. Through over a century of redlining, which were racist practices of mortgage lending and insurance, low-income neighborhoods in some of the largest cities around North America are significantly different in nature than higher income neighborhoods. They don't have tree cover. They are a lot of concrete. They're often located in flood zones. So as climate is changing, as heavy rainfall is getting more frequent, as floods are getting more extreme, as heat waves are getting more dangerous, those neighborhoods are flooding more often. They can be 10 to 15 degrees hotter than a neighborhood in the same city during the same heat wave. The power bills are off the chart. It affects people physically as well. So climate change is taking these inequalities and it's magnifying or exacerbating them. Why is this relevant? Because people often say, well, you care about climate change and I care about this. And my answer is no. If you're a human being living on planet Earth, you have every reason you need to care about climate change. And whoever you are, you're the perfect person to care about it because of what you already care about. It would be fantastic if we could focus on the similarities that we have, like Lisa said, on our superordinate identity. Because what we have in common is so much more than what divides us. Every single one of us depends on this planet for the air we breathe and the water we drink and the food we eat and everything we use, the chair you're sitting on, the clothing you wear, everything comes from this planet. And what divides us pales in comparison to how interconnected we are. But yet, as humans, we focus on that 0.001% that divides us rather than everything else that unites us. And so it would be nice if we could focus on what unites us, and certainly messaging that helps us move in that direction is a good idea, but we can also show how who people already are is the perfect person to care, whoever they are, wherever they live, whatever they care about. I've had thousands of conversations, and only maybe 1 in 1,000 have I ever been able to not identify something that people already cared about that didn't relate directly to climate change, whether it was they were worried about letting their kids play outside when it was too hot and there was too much smoke in the air, whether they worked in an industry that was being affected or affecting climate change, whether they cared about issues of equality or justice, whether they're a person of faith. Whoever we are, we already have those values, and if we can identify those values, we don't have to share them. You don't have to, you know, everybody doesn't have to be working in the same industry or have the same perspective on faith or lack thereof or live in the same place. We can respect each other's differences, but show how the differences we have still make us the perfect person to care about that better future. That decreases that sense of distance that we have, thinking of it as a separate issue that only those people care about. But then when it comes to addressing the issue, we are more politically polarized now in the United States than any time since the Civil War, which relates directly to what Edmund was talking about. And I love that you quoted Abraham Lincoln, because sometimes I wish he could just come back. I think we need him very badly right now. Why is the United States is incredibly divided right now for various reasons. And part of that is simply our access to customized media, because rather than everybody getting the news from Walter Cronkite, we get our news from people who share our perspectives and present opinions and interpretations of that news, not just the same facts. And part of that is because our media is largely for profit these days as well. And we know that we tend to click on things that we agree on rather than we disagree on. So you said, you know, what's the damage done by listening to somebody we don't agree with? Well, I agree with you. We should be listening, but it's hard. It takes emotional investment to listen to somebody we disagree with. And it's very satisfying and reassuring to listen to somebody we agree with. So we tend to seek those out. So where does climate change come in? Does a thermometer give you a different answer depending on how you vote? Does a wildfire knock on the door of your house and say, excuse me, could I see which party you're registered for before I burn down your house? No. It affects us equally. No, I should say, it affects all of us, but it doesn't even affect us equally because those who've contributed least to the problem are being most affected by it. And that's why when we look at those solutions, they must incorporate those justice solutions. It's absolutely essential that they do so. Because we can't fix this alone, we have to fix this together. But here's the thing, so just as climate change affects us all, but it doesn't affect us all equally, so too climate solutions benefit us all, but they can benefit us disproportionately as well. And if we can come together on climate, what else might we be able to fix along the way? If we patch the hole in our buckets, how much easier is it going to make for us to be able to fill those buckets? And so that's why we need each of these scholars and each of these researchers here and each of these advocates here who are all coming at this from different perspectives, perspectives of race and gender, psychology, geography, policy, and more. But we're all coming together to the same place. That place is that better future. When it all comes down to it, that's what we all have in common. We all want that better future. And we can't get there if we don't fix climate change. Climate change is not the goal. Fixing climate change is not the goal. The goal is a better future. Climate change is the hurdle that's in the way of getting to that goal. And so if we have that perspective, that shows us how, again, it doesn't matter what you're studying. Students sometimes say, well, what should I study to help with climate change? And my answer is, study whatever you're interested in, whatever you're good at, because we need everybody. We need people who are experts in communication, people who are experts in law, in medicine, in the physical and the social and the natural sciences, obviously, in engineering, in business, in architecture, in natural resources, in agriculture. We need everybody because this affects all of us. And together, again, we all want that better future.
That was Catherine Hayhoe, chief scientist at the Natural Conservancy and a distinguished professor of political science at Texas Tech University. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the live audience.
Thank you so much for all of these comments. Rudy von Arnhem from the Economics Department. I think that breadth of all of these, this is so interesting. I have one really simple question. Because you're outlining in different ways how we can sort of come together and fix this stuff. Do we have enough time? It seems to me that we don't. And that means that this sort of consensus building and finding shared values and rallying around those and then issuing legislation and moving that through parliament, this is not happening. We don't have the time. And so the question is, what do we do with this program that you propose in light of the challenge that we don't have that time? Because I believe that it would take a long time to build those values and rally around them if that is the solution. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So John Holdren, who is President Obama's science advisor, said when it comes to climate change, and really what's at stake here with climate change is the future of human civilization. That's what's at stake. It's not the planet. The planet will be orbiting the sun long after we're gone. It is our civilization. And he said we have three choices. We can mitigate, adapt, or suffer. We are going to do some of each. The only question is how much. It is too late to avoid suffering because suffering is already happening today. But it is not too late to act because we know, and I know myself, this is what I do. I study what the future looks like depending on our choices. Our choices today will still determine our future. And whether or not human civilization endures is up to us. It's on the table. So it is not too late to make the choices we need. And I often hear people say, when I say the most important first thing any individual can do about this is to talk about it. To talk about why it matters and what we can do to fix it. People say, talk. The time has long passed to talk. Well, I say, well, how has it worked out so far not talking about it in the last 50 years? How has that worked out? Are we further down the road than we were? Not much. So we need to build that shared consensus. But you know what? Unfortunately, as Tom pointed out, the bigger the disasters we have, the faster that shared consensus builds. We were just talking at lunch about the Great Salt Lake drying up and how you are seeing, right? And if you could speak to that, you're seeing more consensus around we need to do something about this because we're seeing things in front of our eyes. And so I think the potential for building that consensus is coming. But again, as a scientist, I know that the more we mitigate now, the less we're going to suffer in the future, and it is essential to move at speed. Would you like to comment too?
You know, I think your point is well taken because politics intentionally moves slowly. It's actually designed to slow down and be a deliberative process. But you also see instances throughout history where if people are concerned enough, change can happen in a fairly rapid period of time. The Great Salt Lake is a good example. You just saw a heavily Republican legislature commit a lot of money Is it too late to commit that money? And what does money have to do with water? Is it really going to have an effect? But it's a good example of an immediate change of focus when it became so apparent it couldn't be denied, where there was a change in the political wind. And so I think we have to remain optimistic. Think about it, we as voters have a chance to change the complexion of a legislature, completely change it every 2 years, if we would. But we don't. We keep reelecting incumbents, we keep complaining, and we keep voting for the same thing. So yes, I think there's hope. Yes, I think things can respond quickly enough. Yes, I think we have to do something at community levels. Geopolitically, you hear the debates, it doesn't matter what we do in our country, there are other countries that are polluting at so much of a higher level that it doesn't matter what we do. Fatalistic approach, and I agree the planet will survive whether we do it or not, but there are steps we can take and we can facilitate change.
So in your book, you talked about how there are some countries that have implemented charging as much as their carbon footprint equivalent, and that has slowed down the temperature increase by 1 degree. Can you elaborate on that? Is there something like that could be implemented in more parts of the country?
It might be. So I think you're talking about carbon pricing, is that right? Okay, yes. So one way to accelerate this transition is through pricing what economists call an externality, which is the fact that we produce all this carbon and it is building up in the atmosphere, wrapping this extra blanket around the planet, causing it to warm, causing huge amounts of economic damages, yet there's no price put on carbon. So most of the economists in the world, including the two who won the Nobel Prize back 3 years ago, agree that putting a price on carbon is a way in a market to incentivize the development of technology and personal actions that increase efficiency as well as use of clean energy. And then what you do with that tax is really important. It's very important to use that to help make sure that lower and medium income households are not penalized for that, because you have to address the justice issue as well. And so there's many countries, including my home country of Canada, that has a federal price on carbon. They've had it at the federal level since 2019. And low and middle income households actually benefit financially from the carbon tax compared to the increased costs. And it is one mechanism to help accelerate this transition. And I think it's really important to point out that there is no silver bullet. There is no piece of technology, there is no one policy, there is no, you know, one size fits all solution, but there is a lot of silver buckshot. There's agricultural solutions, nature-based solutions, efficiency solutions, clean energy solutions, behavioral solutions. There are solutions at every scale and every level, and those types of mechanisms help to accelerate them. And that is why policy is so important, because policy is like the lubricant, sort of, that greases the wheels and makes things happen faster. And so that's why having this discussion right here, I think, is so important.
That's our show. If you'd like to hear another Hinckley Forum, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.